There's no such thing as being too Jewish.
Thank you very much.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish radio show and podcast with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. This morning, our guest is Tim Rubin, author of the new book, Tequila. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. The opinions of the hosts and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. You know, I used to try to see every movie that had a Jewish theme or subject as soon as it came to the theaters. Now, however, like so many other people ever since the 2020 pandemic, I realize I can just wait until films come out on streaming services and then watch them leisurely at home. In fact, the last time I went to an actual movie theater and saw a first-run feature film was probably when Oppenheimer came out. What was that, more than 2 years ago? And it occurs to me that a lot of the time I have the captions on when I watch a movie, so I don't even have to pay attention too closely. In any case, I don't just rush to the cinema anymore to see the latest hot film everybody's talking about. Especially because nowadays people are much more likely to be talking about a streaming TV show than an actual feature film. Now, the other factor here for me as a rabbi is that there are a lot more films and TV series with Jewish themes coming out now than I can ever before recall. And you can watch most of them on streaming services or airplane flights or something without having to actually go to the trouble of parking in a mall garage and paying $10 for a popcorn or soda and being forced to watch 20 minutes of ads before an actual film comes on. Last year, for example, I saw the fine and quite Jewish film A Real Pain on an airline flight, and frankly, it made the plane trip a lot better. All of which is an extended prelude to noting that last week I saw two Jewish media offerings, the very silly movie Bad Shabbos, and the start of the second season of the wildly popular new TV streaming show Nobody Wants This. I watched them on nights when the Baseball World Series wasn't on. Now, both are well-made and well-acted. Both revolve around interfaith relationships. That is, both the movie Bad Shabbos and the TV streaming show Nobody Wants This. And both of these shows focus on the unexpected consequences that interfaith relationships entail. And both raise interesting questions about contemporary Jewish life without necessarily providing any deep answers. If you haven't seen or even heard of the film Bad Shabbos, I urge you to watch it before it disappears from streaming services. It's very silly, ridiculous really, and implausible, but quite a lot of fun. The premise hinges on a Shabbat dinner at the apparently modern Orthodox family of a Jewish young man who's meeting his fiancée's quite Jewish parents from Wisconsin who have come out to see what she's getting herself into. The bride-to-be is converting to Judaism. At one point during the dinner, she delivers an excellent Dvar Torah as part of her conversion process. The movie is slapsticky and fun. It's a comedy with some traumatic overtones of mental illness and accidental death and its cover-up, but the Jewish elements, which are many, are by and large pretty well handled, and the acting is excellent. The interfaith aspect of this whole messy movie is more or less a vehicle for creating tension, and it does so in some highly creative ways. I genuinely liked Bad Shabbos, and the fact that even the most stereotypical characters are treated with humanity and genuine empathy makes it especially Jewish. Now, the streaming show Nobody Wants This was kind of a surprise sensation last year when its first season came out. Featured the relationship between a hot young rabbi, played by Jewish actor Adam Brody, and a non-Jewish podcaster, played by Kristen Bell. Brody, or Rabbi Noah, is the assistant or associate rabbi at what appears to be Sinai Temple in L.A., the conservative flagship shul in Southern California. And while he's initially in line to succeed the senior rabbi in the dream job there, his dream job, by the way, that was past two Jewish guest Rabbi David Wolpe's pulpit, Sinai Temple. Anyway, this interfaith relationship causes predictable complications. Brody's character's mother is memorably played by past two Jewish guest Tova Feldshuh. And as the second season unwinds, watched some of it this week, as I said, we see the impact of Kristen Bell's character deciding not to convert, or at least not yet to convert, to Judaism for Rabbi Noah, Adam Brody's character. The show is generally funny, often sweet, and occasionally preposterous. Frankly, the first season was generally a surprising delight, had many aspects of the congregational rabbinate quite accurately portrayed. Although the workload of a congregational rabbi, in my experience, is way higher than they show it on TV, as is the pressure you're under. Anyway, this season floundered a bit to me. Look, it is theoretically possible these days for a Reform rabbi to seriously date a non-Jewish woman who is not converting to Judaism. Frankly, if the woman was converting to Judaism with that rabbi, it would be a violation of aspects of our professional codes. But for a conservative rabbi to date a non-Jewish woman seriously, even in 2025, one who is not converting to Judaism with anybody, well, I think that would be pretty difficult not to expect negative professional consequences. At a time when 65-75% of all Jewish marriages are interfaith ceremonies, mostly Jews marrying Christians, it is of course inevitable that films and TV shows reflect this reality. How they do so, and if they do so with integrity, well, that's another matter. I think that Nobody Wants This is a fairly accurate portrayal of some aspects of the contemporary rabbinate, at least as it's lived in affluent West Los Angeles, and Bad Shabbos has resonances of what New York Jewish life is like on the Upper West Side of Manhattan for very seriously conservative or more likely modern Orthodox families. Now, if you think that that's how most American Jews live, well, that might be a subject for another edition of Too Jewish. Anyway, watch the movie Bad Shabbos if you can. It's fun, it's a great laugh, and maybe you can skip the rest if Nobody Wants This. But I do recommend the first season. That was a lot of fun. To play us in this morning on the subject of Shabbos, here's a classic melody by Louis Lewandowski of the Shabbat Psalm. You know, not a bad Shabbos, but a good Shabbos. This is Tzadik Katamar in a contemporary recording by the Portnoy brothers.
Tzadik Katamar Yifrach Ke'eres Balvanon Yizge Shetu Yafrichu
was the Portnoy Brothers version of Lewandowski's Tzadik Katamar, The Righteous Shall Flourish Like a Cedar Tree, a psalm for the Shabbat day that's part of the Kabbalat Shabbat, the receiving of the Sabbath. When we come back in a moment on Too Jewish, our guest this morning will be Tim Rubin. He's the author of a new book called Tequila. Tim's a successful Jewish attorney who has turned his hand to writing fiction now, and it's good. Meet him when he joins us in a moment on Too Jewish. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Tim Rubin is the author of a new book, Tequila, A Story of Success, Love, and Violence. He is also a graduate of Harvard and Harvard Law School. Too bad you couldn't get into better schools. I'm sorry about that. A veteran trial lawyer, formed his own litigation firm in L.A. and writes about law and society in nonfiction ways. But this is fiction. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Well, how are you today? It's a great day here in Southern California, which is where I'm calling from. A beautiful sunny day, and I'm delighted to be with you.
It's a beautiful sunny day in Arizona, too, but mostly it's sunny in Arizona, as you might expect. Also Southern California. So this is really a departure. Tell us a little bit about how you got into writing fiction.
Well, actually, I started writing fiction all the way back when I was a kid in high school. I published my first short stories and that kind of thing, and always wanted to do some creative writing, always planned on the novel and this kind of thing. But what happened was I went to law school, and then the career took over. I had to focus on my career and try to develop it. And I think to be good at anything, and certainly to be good as a lawyer, you just have to give yourself to it, focus on it entirely, which is what I did. And then, of course, the next thing that happened was I had children. And children, I had four of them, take time if you're doing a good job. And that's one of the most important jobs in your life, maybe the most important. So I did all the things that you're supposed to do as a dad, soccer, baseball, and basketball coaching, you know, running to the voice lessons and piano lessons, etc. And it was great fun, by the way. I loved being a dad and still, of course, am. But now I'm an empty nester. And those kids are off, and one of them's having their own kids. I'm a grandpa. And the good news for me is I have a little extra time that I didn't used to have. Still practicing law, still going to the office every day. But finally, I could get around to facing that mountain that I've been planning on climbing. And I'm the kind of guy who likes to climb a mountain, can't explain why, but decided that it was time to get to it, and I started writing my book. And it took about a year and a half, honestly. Let me tell you, climbing a mountain like writing a book is no mean feat. It's quite something. I found it quite challenging, and like many mountains, when you climb them, you realize when you're climbing them, gosh, if I had known how hard it is, I don't know whether I would have started, but I did, and I got through it and felt really good about it and frankly enjoyed the process tremendously. So I think I'll probably keep doing it, keep writing, and enjoying the creative process.
We will talk much more with Tim Rubin when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish and continue to explore tequila, although not in the drinking form of it on this show. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a fabulous Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates a terrific array of services, classes, and events this fall and winter. Established exactly 7 years ago by great congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everybody throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimcha Tucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org. We welcome members and guests always in our sanctuary. You can also call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Religious school is going for school-age children and grandchildren. Join us in our terrific Hebrew school, Bar and Bat Mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation, and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with terrific Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org to sign up. All of our services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us. Friday night services are at 6:30 p.m., a full musical celebration of the Sabbath, always followed by a delicious Oneg Shabbat. Saturday morning, Torah study is at 9 a.m. Services are at 10 a.m., always followed by a delicious Kiddush. Always we have homemade challah. And all services are with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Our Facebook page for services, if you can't come in person, is Beit Simcha Tucson, BEITSIMCHA Tucson. All of our Adult Education Academy classes, including Torah study, are taught live and on Zoom. You can access those through our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org. For more about Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school, and Torah Tikes programs, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation, and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, and the fastest-growing Jewish congregation in all of Southern Arizona, Beit Simcha. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail.com, or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 250,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify. Post a rating, review 2Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments all help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of Southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, you spent a long time in the State Department. There's been a lot of press coverage of countries recognizing other countries, like, say, Palestine. But there's a big difference between recognizing the existence of a country and establishing full diplomatic relations with it. Can you explain that a bit?
Yes, there are thousands of steps to take between recognizing a country and establishing full diplomatic relations. So, I mean, from my point of view, recognizing a country is purely a political act that has no practical consequences whatsoever. So you're making a political statement that we recognize the existence of this country. We recognize that it is a country. But you're not specifying what borders you recognize or what government you recognize. I mean, I remember being in a tricky position working for the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad, Pakistan, but going to visit Afghanistan during that country's civil war, long civil war, where there were many factions controlling different parts of the country and even battling constantly for control over the capital. And we had always recognized Afghanistan as a country. We had an embassy in Kabul, where even after we withdrew our ambassador and our diplomatic staff, we maintained local employees on the payroll. And one of the reasons that I had to go so often there was to bring them their pay. Their salary was, you know, in cash, like a suitcase full of cash.
But that must have been a little bit nerve-wracking, I would think.
There were a lot of nerve-wracking things about it. We weren't allowed to use U.S. government vehicles or aircraft for these trips. So we had to use, like, Red Cross planes and then some UN agency or World Food Program or something like that on the ground to drive us around for our meetings. But part of the whole thing about diplomatic relations is, so we didn't recognize any single faction as the legitimate government of all of Afghanistan. So to make that point clear, for PR reasons and for the sake of appearances, I had to visit at least three factions on every trip, even if all I really wanted to do was deliver cash to our U.S. government employees who were living and working in Kabul. So there was this, you know, sort of shell game of visiting three putative capitals per trip. And if you thought Kabul was wild and woolly back in the 90s, you should have seen some of these other places, Mazar-i-Sharif or Kandahar. Hmm. Oh, my God. Unbelievable. So that brings us back to the question of diplomatic relations. All right. Diplomatic relations means establishing a diplomatic outpost with certain rules of operation that are mutually agreed upon, et cetera, but there's like 1,000 steps on the way to doing this. First of all, many European countries who recently announced their recognition of Palestine or their intention to recognize Palestine faced quiet revolution in their foreign ministries because a lot of European diplomats, and I'm sure this is true for American diplomats as well, do not want to live or work in Ramallah.
For sure.
So for reasons you can explain better than I, but that's not anybody's dream assignment.
Not hardly. Right.
They're happy to live or work in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv. Many countries have an embassy in Tel Aviv and a consulate in Jerusalem, and they have different functions. The consulate in Jerusalem, in most cases, is set up to deal with Palestinians, and you know, whether they're Jerusalemites or people from the West Bank, whatever, the job of those consulates is to interact with Palestinian officials, Palestinian citizens, Palestinians seeking visas, whatever. Whereas the job of the embassy in Tel Aviv is to deal with Christian and Jewish Israelis, people who define themselves as Israelis and travel with Israeli passports. So, you know, there's a million shades of gray in all of this, and it varies enormously from country to country. But there is a very long way to go from recognizing a country largely on paper or on the air these days, because nobody uses paper anymore, right?
Right.
So a digital recognition to actually having people on the ground fulfilling the normal functions of diplomats.
So it's symbolic and it's a step, but there's a lot of steps that still follow before you really get there.
Right. And also, each country has different goals in announcing recognition. I mean, as you suggested before, for some countries, this was just like a ploy to encourage Israel to end the war in Gaza.
Right.
It wasn't really about a state of Palestine. That many of these countries are, to say the least, ambivalent about dealing.
Sure. Sure. Tom, thanks so much. It was a valuable explanation. We will talk next week.
I look forward to that.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Arnold, who is 29 years old and still lives at home, comes down for breakfast one morning after a great night out. As soon as he sits down, he says to his parents, "Mom, Dad, you'll be pleased to know I met an amazing girl last night. I was so captivated by her beauty and charm. By the end of the evening, I could clearly see her and me under the chuppah. At last, your son Arnold has found someone. What do you think of that?" His dad replies slowly, "Well, Arnold, sounds like something is happening for you at last. But it's important for you to marry someone who has the same belief as the family." "But Dad," says Arnold, "why do I want to marry a girl who thinks I'm a schmuck?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Vayera, which includes the great and terrible story of the binding of Isaac, the Akedah, in which God tests Abraham by having him almost, but not quite, sacrifice Isaac, his beloved son, on a rock. Famous for being read on Rosh Hashanah morning, its connection seems to be the fact that a ram appears at the end of the story. Caught in a thicket by its horns, it is sacrificed in place of Isaac. It's the model, by the way, those horns, for all future shofars. Anyway, this passage, taken from Vayera, is much more than a mere animal story. Cryptic and oddly repetitive, it raises a host of painful moral dilemmas, challenging us to think intensely about just how deep our relationship to God really is.
God said to Abraham, "Kill me a son." Abe said, "Man, you must be putting me on." God said, "No." Abe said, "What?" God said, "You can do what you want, Abe, but next time you see me coming, you better run."
I'm not saying you should get all your biblical knowledge from Bob Dylan, but here in Vayera, God does test Abraham. Adonai nisah et Avram. That commandment is in triplicate. God tells him to sacrifice his son, his only son, his beloved son, his son Isaac. That super identification of Isaac mirrors an earlier command in the Torah portion of Lech Lecha to Abraham when he began his great journey towards God and monotheism. "Leave," he was told, "leave your land, leave your birthplace, leave your father's home." Now he's being told to kill his son, his only son, his beloved son. Well, there are some problems in this text. Abraham has another son, an older one, Ishmael, so Isaac's not his only son. He's actually the son of his older age with his wife Sarah. Isaac is Sarah's only son, not Abraham's. Frankly, all God had to say there was, "Take your son Isaac," and there would be no doubt who was supposed to head for the sacrificial altar. Why is there all this extra language in the Torah? But the bigger problem is the simple fact that Abraham, who has previously shown a tendency to argue and even fight injustice, as he did in the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, Abraham obeys this terrible command and does so with apparent relish. He doesn't make a peep, doesn't say a single word of objection to God. In fact, we're told he gets up especially early in the morning in order to fulfill this horrible command that God has given him with good energy. The narrative itself sets up the drama, painfully, beautifully, tragically. Isaac, who doesn't know what's happening, goes along with his father. The phrase, "the two walked on together," is repeated, and Isaac asks, "Where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" Abraham replies, correctly but ironically, "God will provide." It's a deeply troubling story. And then, as Abraham is holding up the knife, about to slaughter his own son, an angel of God suddenly intervenes. The murder of the innocent, the sacrifice of Isaac, is stopped. Isaac lives. The future of our people, of Abraham's children, is thus preserved. This story in its place and time was undoubtedly a kind of polemical tale. It was designed to teach the prohibition on human sacrifice. Children are not meant to be slaughtered on the altar of their parents' beliefs. God does not want the blood of the human lamb. Our Lord does not truly desire the destruction of his own children. God desires life. Now, other religions have carried this Akedah story to a different, bloodier, more horrible conclusion, believing somehow that human sacrifice and suffering are the essential elements for a religious life. But the story of the Binding of Isaac makes it clear that killing our own kids and the glorification of the loss of a son will never be acceptable to Jews, to moral people. In fact, Abraham's urgent rush to fulfill God's terrible command to kill his own son reminds us that we have the unfortunate ability to embrace morally bad decisions with great fervor. Sadly, many, many times in human history, we have sent our children off to die for causes that were not ethical. The great World War I poet Wilfred Owen paraphrased this theme in a piece called The Parable of the Old Man and the Young. He wrote, "So Abram rose and clave the wood and went and took the fire with him and a knife. And as they journeyed, both of them together, Isaac the firstborn spake and said, My father, behold the preparations, fire and iron. But where the lamb for this burnt offering? Then Abram bound the youth with belts and straps, and builded parapets and trenches there, and stretched forth the knife to slay his son, when lo, an angel called him out of heaven, saying, Lay not thy hand upon the lad, neither do anything to him, thy son. Behold, caught in a thicket by its horns, a ram, offer the ram of pride instead. But the old man would not do so, but slew his son and half the seed of Europe, one by one." Wilfred Owen was writing of the ways in which his own elders sent his own generation off to die in World War I. But we still engage in such choices. Like Abraham, we still often fail this test. May we learn from the Torah and this Akedah trial of Abraham's to choose life and not sacrifice for our own children. When we return in a moment on To Jewish, our guest, Tim Rubin, shares how he constructed his own peripatetic thriller and why it's called Tequila. Find out all about it when we come back in a moment on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from Rabbi Sam Kohan.
An Alabama man was arrested last week planning attacks on synagogues in Alabama and surrounding states, as well as, perhaps, public figures. Jeremy Wayne Shoemaker of Needham, Alabama, 33 years old, was arrested after the FBI and local agencies were alerted to credible threats of violence he made to local synagogues. During his arrest, law enforcement seized weapons, more than a suitcase full of ammo, body armor, and other items related to the plans of violence in Shoemaker's possession, according to the Clark County Sheriff's Office. Following an investigation, they said they believed Shoemaker had intentions of not being taken alive and potentially planned to attack public figures as well. While the Sheriff's Office said that federal charges were likely, Shoemaker was locally charged during his arrest with resisting arrest and carrying firearms. It was not clear if prosecutors were seeking hate crime charges yet. In 2023, at least five Jewish congregations in Alabama received emailed bomb threats. In 2024, the state saw 67 anti-Semitic incidents, including four where Jewish institutions were targeted, according to the ADL's annual anti-Semitism audit. Shoemaker is being held on a $150,000 bond and is due to appear in court November 7th. In other news, a New York City man who attacked Jewish pro-Israel counter-protesters at three separate pro-Palestinian terrorist demonstrations was sentenced last week to 17 months in prison. U.S. District Court Judge Richard Berman read a letter from Tariq Bazrouk during the sentencing hearing, in which he said, "There was no excuse for my behavior. He let feelings over the suffering in Gaza get the best of me. Bazrouk, who is 20 years old, became a cause célèbre for some pro-Palestinian terrorist activists after he was charged with 3 counts of committing hate crimes back in May, following his arrest in January for punching a Jewish pro-Israel protester in the nose. During 2 preceding incidents, which occurred over a period of 9 months, he also punched, kicked, and hurled anti-Semitic slurs at Jewish counter-protesters. At the time, an investigation by law enforcement found texts on Bazrouk's phone where he referred to himself as a Jew hater and called on Allah to get rid of Jews, according to the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York. During one of the assaults, he wore a green headband, typically worn by Hamas terrorists, and he expressed happiness over learning that a family member of his was involved in Hamas abroad. Bazrouk pled guilty to targeting his victims for their Jewish or Israeli identity in June as part of a plea agreement, including a sentencing guideline of 12 to 18 months in prison. His sentencing also includes 3 years of supervised release. Bazrouk addressed victims in the courtroom and told them, "I'm sorry, guys. Hope you can forgive me for my actions." 2 of Bazrouk's victims also spoke at the hearing. One told the court he was a victim of Bazrouk's vicious campaign against Jews. The other said, "He did not feel in my gut." Bazrouk was remorseful. Judge Berman said during the hearing that the sentencing decision was straightforward. If you assault somebody unprovoked just because that random somebody is an actual perceived Jew, because you, the assaulter, hate Jews, you are going to go to jail. It's that simple, he said. Well, our typical eulogies here on Too Jewish highlight famous Jews who have passed away. This morning, we'd like to honor a guy who is not so well known, but should be. Less than a week after rushing to Ground Zero as a police chaplain on 9/11, Rabbi Alvin Kass, who passed away last week, led Rosh Hashanah services not only for his Brooklyn congregation, but at a makeshift synagogue at LaGuardia Airport for emergency responders who flooded into New York City after the terrorist attacks. "It was the most meaningful religious service of my career," he said later. Kass died last week at the age of 89. He was the longest-serving chaplain in the New York Police Department. He had a career that included responses to global terrorism, local violence, and the intimate needs of police officers, as well as a famous hostage crisis he resolved with a non-kosher pastrami sandwich from the Carnegie Deli. Kass worked until just weeks before his death. A few days earlier, he tuned in from his hospital room to a ceremony honoring him for 60 years of service to the NYPD. As our longtime spiritual director, Kass anchored Shomrim in Torah values and service, guiding us through milestones, line of duty tragedies, and everyday decisions alike, said the Shomrim Society, a fraternal organization for Jewish police officers. "Rabbi Kass's counsel shaped our traditions, his presence steadied our hearts, his example set the standard for what it means to be a Shomrim leader." Born and raised in New Jersey, Kass went to Camp Ramah. Then he enrolled at Columbia University. His freshman year roommates there were Robert Alter, who became a preeminent translator of the Bible and a guest of Too Jewish, and Shalom Schwartz, a leading psychologist in Israel later. After the terror attacks in Lower Manhattan, September 11, 2001, 9/11, Kass reported immediately to Ground Zero, where he encountered a police officer crying like a baby, as well as the families of officers who were unaccounted for. He later attended the funerals of every police officer killed that day, including 2 who were Jewish. "I told their families that you're supposed to say Baruch Dayan HaEmet, blessed is the Lord our God, judge of truth, or truthful judge. That means that he knows what he's doing and we don't," Kass wrote on the 20th anniversary of 9/11. And a more traditional eulogy, we remember Catherine Janus Kahn, the Jewish book illustrator who created Sammy Spider, the wildly popular Jewish kids' books that feature collage-style artwork and multicolor. Little Spider, who wants to know more about Jewish holidays and Jewish stuff. That art was the work of Catherine Janus Kahn, who died October 6th at age 83. May she rest in peace. And that's the Too Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Tim Rubin is the author of Tequila, a Brian Youngman novel, a story of success, love, and violence. You talked about family. Family plays a crucial role. Really, it's kind of central in a way, the Ramirez family. Tell us a little bit about how you evolved the idea of focusing on this agave loving or creating family for your book.
Well, I'll tell you, in fact, people have described Tequila as, you may have seen or heard the show Succession that's been popular recently. Succession meets Narcos, in a sense.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah, and of course, if you hearken back and you're as old as I am, you may remember the shows like Dallas and Falcon Crest. I've always found that family is really the centerpiece of life, and I believe in family issues. There's no such thing as a so-called normal or regular family, because every family has its issues and challenges. And if you combine family with a lot of money and a lot of power and a lot of opportunity, then suddenly things come out. I believe in family loyalty. It's one of the themes of my book. But of course, the key here is that not everyone in the family is going to act quite the same, especially when they're doing the grabbing for power and for money. And that is what happens in Tequila. I mean, Tequila starts in the 50s with the patriarch, Sotero Ramirez, and he's on a family farm that he had inherited, and he finds a new way to do the production of tequila. Then he ends up, the family expands the process. They export it all over the world, and they develop it into this huge, massive company that is based on tequila, but then expands into other products, ultimately hotels, etc. But what Sotero wanted was something for his family for all time, to support his family and be a family company. And so his daughter Marta became the head, and she expanded. And ultimately, my favorite character, Maria, who's moved the company to New York, Manhattan, is the head and CEO, and she has family problems. She has her own split with her own husband, and her son has issues. But more important than that, she's got two brothers who are both serious problems they're creating for her and the company. And the struggles amongst those family members is very central to that triangle is central to what happens in Tequila.
He's kind of a psycho, one of the brothers. I don't know if that's
you're right. I mean, let me be very clear on that. The one of the brothers, which is Miguel in Miami, is just evil.
Horrifying.
One who wants to make it very clear that he is evil, evil, evil. And he does terrible things. And as you go through the book, he keeps doing worse and worse things. I believe in showing very clear to the reader the good and the evil. On the good side, we have Maria and we have Brian Youngman, who are the protagonists, and then, of course, Miguel on the other side. Then you have Tommaso, the other brother in Los Angeles, and you will find that you've seen people like Tommaso. He's an alcoholic, and he's got a mistress, and he's arrogant, and he's lazy, and he's
a lot of bad qualities, but he's not like Miguel, right?
No, Miguel is pure evil. Tommaso is a different kind of negative, and he goes through a process. And, of course, Tommaso's faults bring him to some very bad results. If you read the book, you'll see that he suddenly finds that he's not doing so well as he had hoped he would. But that's part and parcel of the story, and it's fun.
It is fun. I assume you like tequila.
Yes, of course. I do say I'm an equal opportunity drinker. I love tequila, but I'm also a fan of whiskey and other things. But I don't overdo it. Don't get me wrong. You know, Brian Youngman, the protagonist, he's a Jewish lawyer. Okay. He has a Jewish mother. One of the people who read the book came to me and said, "Geez, I'm so glad you put a Jewish mother in there." And it's, because that's just a little bit of fun, because she, of course, gives Brian a little bit of a hard time over the fact that Brian also had to have a divorce, unfortunately. And that is part of what brought him into divorce law. He learned through his own divorce that it's a pretty good way to practice law. And so he after getting divorced. He becomes a divorce lawyer, and that's how he enters the Ramirez family, because he ends up representing a woman who's getting divorced from Tommaso. And that woman, Nora, she wants her big piece of the pie. It's a big pie, and you see this in divorce cases where there's companies at issue, and parties go at it as everyone tries to fight over who gets what and how much in a company. It can be pretty nasty. That said, so Brian Youngman, my protagonist, he is adverse to the beautiful Maria, who is the CEO of Ram. Right. And she's obviously not happy about him and how he is going after the company. But as the story develops, the two of them find that they are on the same path. And then they go through a series of adventures and challenges together. And that's exciting. And, you know, that is a bit of a love story, as you'll find if you read Tequila.
Which you should. So Brian Youngman is a Jewish lawyer with a Jewish mother. I always have to ask this question when it seems like it might be getting a little close to home. Anything autobiographical in that?
Well, you know, how can you not put some of yourself into a book, right? So, I mean, let's face it, it is true that Brian Youngman is a Jewish trial lawyer. He was a prosecutor, and that was his background, and he came out of that, and then he hung his own shingle and started his own firm, and then he moved into, ultimately, divorce work. Well, I'm not a divorce lawyer, although I have tried divorce cases, but I guess I would characterize myself as a man who also is Jewish, who became a lawyer and hung his own shingle. So I know something about what that process is. But Brian Youngman, he's not James Bond, okay? But he knows how to handle himself. He's an expert in judo, and that is an important thing for him. So I will confess that I also practiced judo as a young man, a youngster and a young man, and that kind of thing. So I knew something about the wonderful, wonderful sport of judo, which my character is doing. So, yeah, I took a few pieces of myself, I suppose, and put him in the main character, but I think he's a much more impressive guy than I am, frankly. And I've published a lot of legal articles, and I write about the law and cases and that kind of thing. The legal writing is boring. I don't think most people, unless you are a lawyer who is interested in that particular case or the way a judge came to an analysis, I don't think you'd want to read it. You'd probably, as good as I might make the article, you'd probably glaze over and before you know it. I think that Tequila is fun. I meant it to be fun. I wrote it plot. It's plot-oriented. It's supposed to be fast. I made the chapters short. I don't like long chapters. And so I made the chapters short so the reader could, you know, run through them, and they change locations and they change characters pretty quickly. And I don't use much technical language at all throughout the book, one or two times perhaps, but it's pretty much accessible to anyone. I don't want any kids reading it because it's a little racy, but I do think that young and old can enjoy it and will find that it's easy to read. And is going to keep your attention. I mean, we do go to a lot of places in this book.
Judaism has always focused on the concept of justice. You can make a case that it's the central ethical principle. You know, justice, justice, you must pursue. Tzedek, tzedek, tirdof. Justice is a key element in this book. Tell us about how that plays into your writing.
Well, justice is an important element, but justice is a perspective. I think that's really important. What Maria, for example, thinks of as justice is different from what Brian thinks of as justice. And those perspectives clash. And so I think that's really important. And, you know, you mentioned the Old Testament, I start the book with a quote from the Old Testament. If you noticed, it's the Cain and Abel story. I mean,
yeah.
Think about it. Call it the first family.
Yep.
And
it's very, very dysfunctional, as are nearly all the families in Genesis, I might add.
That's right. That's exactly my point. You get it exactly.
I want to thank Tim Ribbon for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about tequila and to find out, well, I don't mean the alcohol, but the book, and to find out more about you?
Well, timrubin.com. You have to spell Ruben correctly. R-E-U-B-E-N, like the Ruben sandwich. And if you go there, it talks about me, it talks about the book, there's some special little things there. Some interviews and that kind of thing. It's also, you can order the book through timrubin.com. It's on Amazon as well.
Tim, thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
Well, it's been a pleasure. I've enjoyed it and enjoy Arizona. It's one of my favorite states.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of Southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week for another great edition of Too Jewish. Our guest will be Brad Meltzer, History Channel host, author of the new book, The Nazi Conspiracy. Join us, Congregation Beit Simcha, Friday night. Services in Onik Shabbat at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning, 2. 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading, and Kiddush, in person and on our Facebook page. In a week or two, I'm heading to Azerbaijan on a Zionist Rabbinical Council mission trip and to Israel. Our playout this morning comes from the top Jews of Azerbaijan, the mountain Jews, known as Juhuri. The song is called Ayan. My friends, may you enjoy a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of peace.
Too Jewish is sponsored by Too Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona. Yet you're the day.